This is Paul Hurt and Jennifer Sweeney of Arizona State University speaking with Lee Kuan Wasioma of the Hopi Tribe up in Kikotsmovi on Saturday, September 8th, 2018. Lee, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me on this discussion. I appreciate it.
Great. Can you start by telling us your name, the positions that you've held with the Adaptive Management Program, and the years that you've been involved?
I was the former director for the Hopi Tribes Cultural Preservation Office for 30 years, and I retired last year in December of 2017. So in my capacity, I got actually right in at the front when the new EIS was happening back in the late 1980s. Mm-hmm. I got hired in 1988. And so my involvement with this whole initiative on the effects of the fluctuating dam releases has been like 30 years.
Wow. Yeah. So you were hired as the Hopi Cultural Preservation Officer in 1988?
Yeah.
And it was 1989 when the federal government decided to start an environmental impact statement, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And what role, like who first came to you and said, we would like some Hopi participation in this EIS, and how did that evolve over time?
Well, to be frank, nobody came to the Hopi, much less to any tribe that is currently engaged with the whole history of the dam. And I just happened to, I believe, back around early 1990, read in the Flagstaff Daily Sun that there was a meeting on the Grand Canyon Dam and by the Bureau of Reclamation. And I was reading the newspaper, and I just, out of curiosity, I didn't know really what it was about, except that, you know, it pictured the dam up there. But I never realized that it was in dealing with the whole canyon. Mm. But that was how I got whiff of something happening. So I went to that meeting. It was an evening meeting. And I sat there listening to it, and there was a whole series of presentations on jump-starting the EIS. And as the initial introductions came around, all the federal agencies, of course, introduced themselves. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs was introduced from Phoenix. And I learned later that they were representing all 19 tribes in the state of Arizona. And I sat there, and actually at that meeting, I was probably the only Native person there. You know, and I was kind of bewildered. And that's when I began to say, we got to learn more about this, what's going on, this EIS. And so I got a lot of handouts then, you know, some background information. And I took home a whole bunch of that. Mm-hmm. And I began to read it, and it was indeed about the Grand Canyon Dam. But what was interesting to me was that the whole issue was, again, the water releases and the effects on the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And I said, this has to be of interest to the tribe. I mean, it is an interest to the tribe. So I got around to just studying it more, and then meeting with our tribal officials over there, and I said, look, this is something that I think we got to pay attention to. And that's where, you know, I personally got involved with it. And so on the next meeting, which was up in Salt Lake. Wow. You know, of course.
The regional office. And
of course, that's time and money to us. And so I ended up doing some calls up there, and pretty much still articulating at least my personal interests as the director on behalf of the tribe to follow it and to keep us abreast of it with information. That kind of stuff is part about the only thing I did. And then the next meeting, again, it was in Phoenix, so I went to that one. And by that time, I had reasonable assurance that the tribe, meaning the tribal council, wanted to actively participate. So I finally had the floor given to me, and I introduced myself. And at that time, I was still the only tribal representative. And I said, the Hopi tribe will engage in this whole EIS, but independent of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and their representation of other tribes. We're, I believe, quite capable of representing ourselves. That's what I said. So that was put on record. All right, so that was sort of my foot in the door, so to speak. And so that was that began our start in trying to figure out, well, how are we gonna participate, you know? And by that time, I think by the third or fourth meeting I was in, then I began to know that there were beyond the federal agencies, there were now a lot of other interested parties to this whole initiative, and that suddenly just blossomed in front of me, and so that was something that I was a bit overwhelmed with as to what that really looked into the future. How is all of this thing gonna work out, and how is that agency involved? How is that state involved? You know, it all centered around quite simply around contiguous lands to the Colorado River, all up to Wyoming. You know, I mean that's what I learned. And they were interested parties in the dam, even though they were upstream. Well, and then, so I went back, and I in the 90s, I was trying to figure out what we're going to do, and then I finally said, well, looks like this EI is going to require a lot of science, a lot of research. And by golly, I gotta determine what our focus was gonna be. And it was the whole gamut of all three sciences, you know, biological, natural, and cultural. And of course, our forte, even though I was just beginning the office at that time, was gonna be culture. Even though I kind of was already thinking they're all interconnected, you know, for Hopi. They're not specific unto themselves. We have values going all over those three sciences. I knew that as a Hopi in here. But we have to develop a baseline for the other two sciences. So that's why this was kind of in my mind, and you know, I'm not a professional archaeologist. You know, my degree is in business. You know, but I've been in different capacities with the tribe. I've been exposed to different kinds of components of our culture, and I grew up being Hopi. But back then, as I look back, I was pretty young. Culturally, I was wet behind the ear. You think you know everything when you're 38, but you don't. And over the time of my career, I was taught good lessons that I had a lot to learn. But in here I was Hopi. And growing up, you learn about stories about the Grand Canyon. It is a very highly respected place as you begin to understand different parts of what importance or sacredness means, you know. My grandfather, who I suspect was born in about 1880, they were among the last, they were the last group of young men who got initiated into these highly ritual societies in 1902 from Oraibi, village of Third Mesa here. And they're required after that initiations the following year in the fall, they did those salt pilgrimages. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. And we listened to those stories. And all he could tell us was that it took a long time to travel on foot with mule, donkeys, and some horses all the way up to the descent place on the Little Colorado. And then going down into the gorge and how precarious that is. And that part of the initiations was to really test the manhood of everyone, both their physical, emotional, and spiritual manhood. And that's what these men and young men undertook. And this was the stories that we heard, where they finally got salt from the Hopi salt mines and then traveled back to the village, and that concluded their full initiations.
That was the salt deposits in the canyon wall, yeah, down near the confluence,
yeah,
of the Colorado,
right,
River and Little Colorado.
Yeah, okay. Right there.
And your grandfather took those pilgrimages.
Yeah. So you kind of learn a little bit about it, but as a youngster, as a teenager, you don't really sense the importance of these stories until later, you know. So the canyon is just so significant to the Hopi people. You know, our genesis, we say, comes from the Grand Canyon. We emerged from a place called Sipapuni. It's, of course, a symbolic place, but it's a shrine down there where the Hopi clans emerge into the present world. We were greeted here by a spiritual person we call Masa, and he accepted us. He accepted us. So out of this encounter and emergence, we immediately already had a physical knowledge of the Grand Canyon. So today, after the Hopi villages were settled around 1040 or so, then the Hopi culture, of course, fully evolved into what it is today. And part of what our belief system is that we believe that when a person passes on, your spirit rises after the fourth day and travels to the Grand Canyon. That's our spiritual home down there. And then from there, you turn into a spirit that we call the cloud people. And they're the people that continue to visit us, our ancestral people, in the form of clouds, you know. This is who we petition to come visit us and bring us rain. So the genesis and then our spiritual home is how the Hopis view the Grand Canyon. So I thought and thought, I said, we have to be involved. And I said, we are going to have to look at our own culture, and we're going to have to, in this EIS, if we're going to make any kind of impact, we're going to have to document our interest into there. So that was the first, actually, research project that I engaged in. And money was the part that I didn't know how we didn't have. But after a series of meetings, they were now engaging in contractors, you know, to conduct different sciences within the scope of the EIS. Mm-hmm. And I said at one of the meetings, I want that money too. You know, I want that money too. And they didn't plan for that. They didn't plan that the tribes were going to be interested parties into the EIS. So they basically didn't have any allocations for, quote, a tribal component of the whole research. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you got to find it. And I'm going to give you a research design, and I'm going to give you our budget. And you're going to give me that money. So that took about a year for me to kind of really absorb things, and then also internally I had to do my education.
Relationship building with the tribal council,
with the tribal council. Uh-huh. And then by that time, probably by 1990-91, I had a kind of like a cultural advisory team of elders. And they were my advisors on a lot of things. But this was a good project for me to bring to them. And
do you remember about what year that was?
91.
91.
Yeah, because that's when I hired Dungoski too. I hired Dungoski. I had hired another archaeologist, David Carmichael, who's currently teaching up at UTEP. And I think he was in the initial stages of this EIS with me. He was an archaeologist too, but he didn't stay for too long. Then I hired Kurt. So we teamed up together, and worked with our advisory team, and they were really, really good, very honorable gentlemen that worked with us. They were religious priests, and some of them were religious leaders, you know. So they gave us a lot of cultural advice and caution. So with that, then I told Kurt, well, you go to next meeting with me, which we did. And that's how both of us began to get immersed into the process. And I think around that time they hired Dave Wagner. Dave Wagner, and he had been he was helping all of some of the contracts that were being dished out, and he was at an office over in Flagstaff. So we got acquainted with him. So he I guess he was in the audience when I told him that I want that money too. So we met with him, and that was still the question. We want our share of the pot, and we're prepared to give you a research proposal with our budget. All right. And so he advised us that he had to do his internal, he was very receptive. He was very receptive, and he generally apologized to us on behalf of the whole effort, the Bureau of Reclamation, that the tribes were just forgotten of this whole process. And he was good. He immediately said, I'm going to see that you get the money. So within 2-3 weeks, he said, all right, we need to meet. So he came out to Hopi and he got introduced to our advisory team, which gave him a very nice warm reception. And then we talked nuts and bolts and said, so me and Kurt handed him our research design, which had the review of the advisory team. And we gave it to him and gave him our initial project, our initial budget. And initially I was under the impression there was just going to be like a year. I've never been engaged in an EIS, you know? and so I was inclined to say, we give him a 1 year budget, get as much money as we can, you know? But as it turned out, it was going to linger on, you know? Like 7 years. All right, so we hammered out a contract. And then I went before the tribal council, and with a tribal council, by 1991, when we were starting meeting with Wagner, I went before the tribal council and got a resolution declaring that we were going to be a cooperating agency. We would have that status. So I remember at the next meeting, I introduced that resolution, gave it to them, and they gave me a seat. And the chairman had wrote to them that I would be the Hopi tribe's voting member. So I became the first tribal voting member. And this needs to be highlighted. We became the first cooperating agency. See, Hopi. And I became the first voting member on the cooperating agency. So that was taken care of in that manner. And then we got our budget and we took a look at all three sciences. How are we gonna look at each one of them? So our initial research design did capture that again, they're integrated. See, that's how our initial proposal went into. And that became part of this later history of how the Hopi tribe actually, me and Kurt, writing really the concept of adaptive management of the Grand Canyon dams. Hopi wrote that, the initial concept. All right, and I'll tell you why. So out of that, then in 91, I believe prior to the awarding of our contract and our status, I went on a river trip. Me and two other staff, we went on a river trip. And it was an eye-opener. Sorry about that. It was an eye-opener for me. You know,
that would have been like 1990 that you went on the river trip?
I think early 90 I was on that river trip just because they offered it to us.
Was this other members of the EIS team were taking one of their
research
trips?
It was just a Hopi trip with Dave Wagner. And in 91 thereabouts, we had our first formal science trip with Jan Balsam and them. I think that's about the date. So we were the first tribe and people to actually engage in this investigation. And that first trip was an eye opener for me. And so, you know, you're actually advised not to go to the Grand Canyon that much, the Hopis, because of our respect for the spiritual people, that their domain. So So Hopis have that in themselves that we should be visiting it, visiting it, visiting it. We don't do that. And I still don't do that. You know, just occasionally when I have to. But so that was an eye-opener for me, because you can go to the rim and you're awe-stricken. It is so huge, you know? And every time you go there, it still impacts you. Mm-hmm. And no wonder our grandfathers talk about how Hopis have to be so respectful for the canyon. It's alive. It talks to you. Everything down there, the ecosystem, is alive and it talks to you. And I looked over, I go back and go back and reminisce about times I looked over the rim. When you finally get out of Marble Canyon, get out of Marble Canyon, out of this one bend, canyon just, it swallows you. Mm. It is different looking down when you see the little river, and then being down there and seeing how massive the canyon is. That was a teacher. And that's why I said, no wonder our grandparents talk about this trip down there, about how significant the canyon is and what it does to you. If there's any experience that gave my grandpa humility and me humility, it was that trip into the canyon.
On that trip, did you bring some of your Hopi elders who were on
couple
your advisory
of,
committee?
No, I didn't do. Yeah, well, two staff were older people. Mm-hmm. That there were three of us that went. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they were in their 60s by that time, and I was like 38 or 39. So it was an eye-opener in that way. And we went through, and you know, of course, at that time, we were still doing the little boats. And that was a heck of an experience, you know, to eventually survive all of the rapids downstream. I don't know if you guys have ever been down there, but it's a pretty arduous trip, you know, and it's just an amazing ecosystem. So by 91, I believe around that time, we got our funding, and we got our first river trip down there, and we had asked, and that time I began to know Jan Balsam too. I think she was just getting started as well, too, about the same time. I think she started with the Grand Canyon about 88, mm-hmm. Too, that thereabouts. So she went with us, because one of our efforts was to investigate as many archaeological sites down there. All right, so that was our first attention down there. Mm-hmm. And from Lee's Ferry all the way to Phantom Ranch, there's 300 plus archaeological sites. Wow. All the way from there. A lot of it clearly ancestral Hopi, because of the Hopi pulp, polychrome and yellowware down there. Uh-huh. And it matches our traditions in there, because the Hopis, they say they traded with other clans down the Grand Canyon from here, you know. And they say that the Wupatki people from Flagstaff, they traded with the Grand Canyon people. You know, things like that are tradition. So when you go down there and begin to learn about the archaeologists will tell us, well, there's evidence of Hopi yellowware here. Could it be trade items? Could be actually visitations by people? Probably both, you know. So that reinforced our interest down the canyon. So we went through that canyon first, and we began to take a look at arc sites that were in what they call the study corridor, which was the high water level, you know. And that prevented us from doing much with other sites adjacent on in the, within the canyons. We
higher above the river,
we didn't look
in that zone.
And things like that that kind of were restricting us, although we did visit a lot of those sites in the canyon. But initially that was our intention span, and so talking with Jan, who was still also then learning about the whole impact and the archaeology down there, I think we began to help her understand our viewpoints on what we call our ancestral sites. See, so that's how we started with those visits down there, and then as we took that first trip with our crew and some elders, there was one, I think, 78-year-old guy that one was on that first trip, that first research trip. Actually, two of them. As we went through, we were interested in collecting some of the plants because they were culturally important to us, you know? So we were inquiring, you know, let's take a little bit here because that's what we make. We use these willow to make our prayer sticks. Things like that were popping up, you know. And there were other types of pollen out there. I think that was during the spring trip. And they began to gather that as well. And in one of the site hikes that we went into Buck Canyon, I think, one guy said, he was tailing us. I said, "Hey, you guys, come here." So we went back there. And he said, there's wild spinach all over here, he said. And we looked up. Yeah, they were nice spinach we call weewa. So coming back, then we harvested armfuls of that, and we had that for supper, you know. So clearly, our interest in the biological research was there, you know, and it grew. It grew over the 7 years we were doing the river trips like that. See. So, for example, we learned about the invasive species, of which, of course, is tamarisk. We learned about other invasive species up the Little Colorado River because we went up to Sipapuni. Camel thorn, you know.
Terrible plant.
and all of that we learned. But so some of the questions is, how do you feel about eradication of tamarisk down there? Well, on one of the trips, we went, I think we were going somewhere, we stopped, and there was a whole tamarisk, kind of like this here, that's tamarisk through there, kind of really thick. And you know what? There are a lot of finches through there. And one guy said, "Look, how can we destroy their habitat? They're alive and well up here." So this dichotomy of trying to mitigate invasive species now went this way when the tribe even saw value in the tamarisk thickets. See, this is what we were doing down there. So, and then I remember on our first trip, where only three of us went, I remember camping that one night, first night, like that. Next morning, the river was way down here, and we were camped where a boat was stuck. And so The boatman knew it, but at the time that we landed at camp, it was high water. So of course they had to unload everything. So they pitched the boat right there, and then those boats are really, really heavy. I mean, those little boats are pushing, tugging,
trying to get back to the water level. And that's because the dam operations were releasing less water, and it's not that, you know, there was
so that's what we learned, you know, is really the effects on this whole ecosystem out there because of especially the initial releases where it was basically unregulated, you know, and how WAPA, of course, is just goes with what the power demand is, right? Vegas and elsewhere that they sell that power. So in the high power demand periods, then they go as high as 100,000 CFS. And so we had to explain to our elders, what is CFS, you know, cubic feet per second. So kind of this box here. It holds about 5 gallons, you know, that kind of stuff. And then during low power demand, it goes down as low as 3,000 CFS. This was this huge fluctuation. So that captured my attention. No wonder. And it's about time. It's about time they regulate that, was me and Kurt's opinion. So we came in later with a clear vision of the purpose of the EIS and what the tribal contributions were gonna look like from Hopi. So we hired a contractor, and Dave Wagner was kind enough to give us money after year. And we hired a contractor by the name of T.J. Ferguson. Mm-hmm. You're probably familiar with the name or have met him.
Yeah, saw his report.
And we eventually filed the Grand Canyon Ethnohistory Report. Very extensive report.
That was a great study.
Very great, very significant stuff. And that took that many years and a couple of years of writing it to finally come up with a report. So, of course, out of that, the record of decision came about, so it narrowed the fluctuation. Mm-hmm. And so today, Hopi, I believe, if you take a look at the Bureau of Reclamation's tribal reports, I believe we have the most extensive scientific reports based on our research design, and then later how we identified certain research areas as we traveled from the first time that we started going down there. You know, so in one area we monitor sediments. In another area we hired the sediments on several cases where it's clearly has a conflict between tamarisk and willow. We monitor that. So of course, all the time we're taking photographs. And initially we're looking at old photographs of those respective areas. Mm-hmm. And that's our record up to now that we're doing. See, and at the same time, annually we take about 10 Hopis down the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. And they give us either this past month, in September, we took, early September, we took 10 and six of them were new people and younger people. Mm. So we try to mix them up. But every year we get new perspectives, and technically new perspectives, but really the perspectives are consistent. The prior, before going into the Grand Canyon, how they feel about it, that's pretty consistent. after they go through the river trip and learning about what we do down there and the science we're doing, the cultural resources down there, you know, coming out, a lot of the new timers are, they have a better perspective on how those are being affected by the dam operations. But they're pretty consistent all throughout. Mm. And so I think that's indication that the Hopi culture is unwavering. It you know, our villages are 1,000 years old. The Hopis still have a full 12-month ceremonial cycle, you know. And today we're going into the women's ceremonies right now. So it never ends for us. It never ends. We're always in the Kiva. So I think it reflects the vibrancy of the Hopi culture. And we're fortunate to be able to say that. So I think when I think back, I think our participation was worth our while. And today, since 98, thereabouts, we're engaged in what they call monitoring trips now. Mm-hmm. So those, we still are building up our record through there.
Each year, there's a river trip, and
every year.
I think Mike Yates just told me he just got off the river.
Yeah, that was our Hopi trip, yeah.
Uh-huh. Do you miss going down the river? You
didn't. Yeah, I miss going. I've gone down there about maybe out of 30 years, about 11 times. Because I, maybe even less, because I just have that respect for the canyon. Mm-hmm. But I'm the leader too, you know, and Mike always kind of is desirous that I should be on the trip, but you know, here I said I shouldn't be doing that many times. But so later other tribes joined us.
Do you remember who the second one was?
I think it was the Zunis.
The Zunis then got on.
Yeah, and then the Navajos came in, Hualapais and Paiutes came in, and I don't know. I said, we have the thing that I guess personally concerns me, you know, because our Hopi trips are very, very, I think, culturally respectful. From day one, I said no alcohol on our trip. No alcohol, period. And when our first trip with Jan, I remember our boatman took alcohol. Mm-hmm. You know, and we advised him that our trips are non-alcoholic. So over time, our reputation grew that we knew so much about the history of the Grand Canyon culturally. The archaeological sites, the petroglyphs we're interpreting left and right down there. Our values in terms of the erosion of, the effects of erosion on burials, what that causes us to have to now rebury only a partial of a remain, right? Those were emotional. So the boatmen, of course, were learning, and the Hopi trip just grew. And everybody wanted to be on the Hopi trips. And every one of those trips, the boatmen later vowed that they would not be taking alcohol on it. So since then, our trips have been non-alcohol. And I think the tribe's reputation on the river is there, you know. Whereas through today, and I still complain to the other tribes, the Zunis still take alcohol. Navajos is a big fishing trip for them. Paiutes take alcohol. Hualapais take alcohol. I told them one time, you guys just need to stop. You guys keep telling everybody that you have respect for the canyon. At least stop that. I mean, that's just kind of my personal thing, but that's because, you know, how much I think we value the canyon. It's kind of ironic too, because of course all the commercial trips take that, and lots, there's a lot of occasions, because we take our ceremonial pipes and our native tobacco. So at the end of the day, at the end of the day, after we pitch camp, then the Hopis gather in a circle and we pass the pipe. We give thanks for a nice day and a good day, you know, thank for everything. There's many times where the Hopi camp is right next to a commercial camp, where the Hopis are meditating and these guys are drinking and laughing over here, and the Hopis are trying to meditate. It's like that throughout the river, and
quite a contrast.
Yeah, it's been a good experience for me to engage in the river trips. And then later now these monitoring trips that we have now, and to be able to be a part of getting new people to go down there, mm-hmm. and to so that they can also begin to get another view of the Grand Canyon, which I like I did.
You mentioned Dave Wegner being very supportive and helpful. I wonder if you can talk just a little bit about how, as leadership of the adaptive management program evolved over time, how your personal relationship with other members of the AMWEG and the Hopi tribe's larger relationship with the whole adaptive management program, how that changed over time. Were there different phases where things were really cooperative and then other phases when not so much? How did it evolve?
Well, after, you know, initially it was, of course, the was the members as cooperating agencies. You know, that was the first cohort of people coming together, you know, throughout the until the Record of Decision came about. Mm-hmm. So they were already now a developing list of stakeholders. It grew. Mm-hmm. And so I went through that, and Mike became the my alternate as a voting member, Mike Yates. Mm-hmm. Well, Kurt initially, and then more recently Mike. And I think the adaptive, the cooperating agency group, I think was it was pretty routine. Everyone of those stakeholders had a different kind of interest in it, mm-hmm. you know, there was a lot of emphasis on biological resources, particularly the humpback chub. So the humpback chub budget, even through today, is given a lot of more money than the tribes together. That's how this disproportionate the budgets were. And I learned that fast, especially once it got into this whole process of fighting for money. Mm-hmm. Your university was getting millions of dollars to pump out PhDs. And when you look at the pie chart, we're buried into recreation, little slice. Mm-hmm. It's still like that. Mm-hmm. So we were fighting for budgets through, once we got into the monitoring and the adaptive management work group, that's where, you know, again, budgets came around all the time, and people were still justifying their money. And that became a challenge to all the tribes, but we were able to form a block of votes between the four or five tribes and then the interior agencies. That's how it was set up. So if the tribes made a motion on their whatever they wanted to put before the whole group, when it came to a vote, then those interior people would vote for the tribe. That's how the politics were working out. Until the solicitor said that they couldn't do that anymore. So we lost about four or five agencies of our blocking vote.
Under Ann Castle. When the interior agency stopped voting.
Right. Yeah, that's when they stopped and they took those votes away from us. So now we're again in a minority. See, still through today. And so
do the tribes often vote as a block? Do you all talk to each other and coordinate
positions?
Yeah, we have positions
and over the last 10 years prior to the AMWIC meetings, we have a day before we have a tribal caucus. So we have, of course, by that time we have the full package. So we have an idea of what's going to be in store for us and what some of the action items, if any, are going to be important to us and what the tribal discussion is going to be. And I tell you, this is not being I don't know how you would put it. When it came to something like a sudden kind of turn of events where a discussion started and the whole group started talking, almost all the tribes would look at me and say, "Lee, what do you think?" You know, I was going through that and the action item and the motions and amendments to the motions, all of that thing that goes on. And then the subject at hand, "What do you think, Lee?" And I'm trying to scratch my head and then I give it my best shot, you know. So in that way, I was sort of still kind of leading the group in discussions too. And I'm glad for my colleagues, you know, Charlie Bullets from Paiute, Tim Begay from Navajo. There were several councilmen from Zuni, and they get appointed every 2 years, I think, to AMWIC. L. Downer from Navajo initially, too, as well.
What was the name of the first Navajo you mentioned?
Somebody? Tim Begay.
Tim Begay.
Tim Begay. He was usually the one that was usually present. L. Downer came in occasionally. He was their director.
How do you spell his name?
Ellen Downer, D-O-W-N-E-R.
And he was also a Navajo rat.
Yeah, he was the tribal historic preservation officer. And Tim Begay was their cultural specialist.
And you said Charlie Bullets? How do you spell his last name?
B-U-L-L-E-T-S.
E-T-S.
Yeah.
And he represented one or the whole collection of Paiute.
He represented the consortium of Paiutes. And then
these were early participants?
Yeah, these were some of the people that I worked with early on. Tim is still engaged, Tim Begay. Now they have a new director called Richard Begay. So they're pretty nice guys.
Who did you work with the Zuni?
It was Octavius Seotiwa. Octavius S-E-O-T-E-O-T-E-W-A, I think. Seotiwa.
Seotiwa. Zuni.
Yeah.
And who did you work with Wallapai? trying.
With Loretta Jackson. Yeah. She was a very strong advocate, too. She was articulate.
She's on our list to do soon.
Yeah, she was a very strong advocate of our collective involvement.
It's strange. We hear from we've heard from other people too, besides you, that the Havasupai tribe was not often.
I went down actually, and because they weren't willing to participate, and one of the chairmen went down there, and I presented some guidance to them, trying to encourage them that they should be participating, but they never did. Mm-hmm. They never did, which is unfortunate, I think, because, you know, of course, their canyon goes right into the canyon,
right.
The big canyon.
Right.
Yeah.
Why, can I ask you why you thought it would be important to get as many tribes represented as possible?
Well, like I said, I learned quickly that once, in particular, the Amway got organized and was seated, it was plain and simple politics for a number of reasons. You know, one I mentioned, of course, is budget, and then, of course, some of the debate on different, for example, water releases, for example, and the timing of those releases. I think at our caucuses, fortunately, the Hopi tribe had a hydrologist too, we had our own hydrologist, so he was helping us from the technical side. See, so we were able to kind of roundtable some of these issues and then go in to see what we can do. And then the big one was the electrocution of those
fish.
Trout.
Uh-huh.
That was a big controversy initially to Hopi, because we were the only ones that commented on that proposal. So our record stands that one, the initial area that they were going to zap those trout by the thousands was right at the confluence, you know?
A sacred site.
A very sacred site to us, you know? And it encompasses this kind of concept of the spiritual domain. So, while it's our finality, as I told you, it was also the beginning of our spiritual life. I one day hope to become a cloud person, to visit all of you people. That's how we believe. So it's a beginning of life for us. So I said to Kurt, you know how I would best explain it? Is that if they kill all these fish, they're taking life away from living creatures. And Hopi, when they do their prayer feathers and prayer offerings, it's for the perpetuation of life. It's not for the end of life. Nah. So even though that proposal had a purpose, because the effect on the humpback chub and the overpopulation, you know, it just didn't sit well with me.
Mm-hmm.
If they dare do that, it's going to create this aura of death. That was our argument, and we got the Bear Reclamation here. So they moved that area to someplace further up the river. See, these are some of the things that we were engaging in too.
Yeah, yeah. Did you, about when did this tribal caucus begin to form? Was it after the Record of Decision,
yeah.
Or did it start forming before that?
No, I think the actual caucus itself began to form after Amway was established.
Uh-huh.
Prior to that, with the research part of it, we were pretty independent, and we would, as cooperating agency, meet, but we didn't have really, as I understand, really have a, quote, a united front, so to speak. We would talk during lunch and stuff like that, but it was right after Amway that we dedicate ourselves to having this caucus prior to the Amway meetings.
And is that still functioning today? Is there still a caucus day before the regular Amway meetings?
Yeah.
And if you had more tribal representatives, you would have a more powerful caucus, you were thinking?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. But you didn't, was there any problem with, you know, you mentioned funding problems a couple of times. Many other people that we talked to, this is a really, you can't get anything done if you don't have financing to get it done. Mm-hmm. And there's a limited pie. Was there ever any thought that more tribal participants would mean less money for each of the tribes? Or was there a set amount of money that everybody got regardless?
It was a set of money that was eventually given to each tribe, respective tribes. Although the Hopi tribe got funded for some specific proposals.
Some research proposals.
Research proposals.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if other tribes did, but we got additional money. It was coming out of something called the Terrestrial Funding Program, and
for biological research.
For biological research, because we were beginning to document everything down there, not just the plants, but because everything that we have around here has some cultural value. The water life, you know, of course, the fish, the frogs, the snakes, the birds, even the wildlife up there. One elder said that when we saw a rattlesnake around there, he made a very interesting comment. You know, during the fall towards the winter, when it gets cold, they hibernate. They're going to go into their den somewhere. Isn't the water going to suffocate them when they go up? You know, no one really thought about that.
Mm.
And that's right, because we still have the snake dance today. Mm. It's an ancient, ancient ceremony that was just performed 3 weeks ago again.
Mm.
So the value on our reptilian relatives, we call them, because once we go through that snake ceremony, they're presented back to the ground after they're captured, and they become our messengers, our prayers. So there's a value in this, elder said. Doesn't that happen to the snakes when the water goes up and floods? You know? And that was something I never thought of.
Mm-hmm.
So engaged in that. We talked about the bird life up there, and then the like I said, it's just an amazing ecosystem. You wouldn't imagine until you go down there, and there's creeks coming in from the top somewhere from different aquifers, just some wide, some small, but they're coming into the canyon, you know. And if you go up in some of those creeks, it is just rich in vegetation. Just, oh man, you know, all kind of plants, just an oasis. And you would never guess that that was in the canyon, right? So yeah, we began to get information and research into all kinds of biological resources. You know, so yeah, so we got money to do that part two. So today we have a handbook that we got developed of all of the biological, in particular the biological and the cultural resources in a handbook like that. And that's given to all of our river participants to read prior to going down there, to look what already has been documented you know, and they're doing that. So that was a product of it, and that product is now also available into the school system. Yeah, where
the
students are learning from that handbook too. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you think the caucus, the tribal caucus, related to the rest of the members and stakeholders of AMWIG, and how what that relationship was like? Was it real cooperative? Was it tense? Did it change over time?
I don't think there were that many really controversial issues that in which the tribe had to argue for the merits of their position.
Mm-hmm.
I think as best as I know and remember, I think all of the AMWIG membership were highly professional, very, very professional and very courteous to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the tribe showed that respect in return too. So I don't think it was contentious. They just knew that we now had a voting bloc. And I think there was slowly some recognition that our participation was there to stay. So I think they had to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when we did our presentations, and Hopi did their presentations too, you know. For example, we did PowerPoints initially, and still do, about why we chose to participate, what the values of the canyon is to the Hopis, and how the dam operations affected that. We outline that, you know, every year, and remind the people that's the Hopi reason why we're here. We do that too. So me and Mike were doing PowerPoint presentations. And then other tribes came in too, and they would begin to have slots within the agenda. So they would provide us those opportunity to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
Then of course during the discussions, we would, if we had any kind of comments or questions, we would ask those questions too. So I think the dialogue was basically good.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got to know a lot of people. You know, some became my friends, you know, and certainly, you know, the non-government organizations, the river guides, for example, they became allies with the tribes.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Sierra, I don't know if the Sierra Club was in there, but other
Grand
organizations,
Canyon Trust, maybe.
Grand Canyon Trust, they you know, they were. Certain times they voted for the tribes too. So things like that, but it wasn't really political,
uh-huh.
But they knew our presence was there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's good. I know that there was some resistance early on, very early in the program. We keep hearing from interviewees that the water and hydropower interests, like the Bureau of Reclamation and WAPA,
mm-hmm.
really resisted making significant adjustments to the management of the dam to accommodate biological and cultural issues. Did you experience any of that in the years that you were involved?
Oh, yeah.
Were there caucuses of the, say, the hydropower and water interests that would work together?
You could. Once you got to know all the agencies represented, I mean, you know that you had respective caucuses.
Hmm.
The power interests were usually on one end of the table, and the tribes would be here, and the NGOs would be here like that, you know, and the feds would be one. Yeah, and sometimes, yeah, they were very, very strong in their opinions.
Uh-huh.
And I told the chairman, you know, every one of the state representations on AMWIG are attorneys, lawyers. That's who we battle with, you know. I'm not an attorney, but they are. And they argue that. They argue that. And so that's sort of the chasm that I think existed in some ways between the power interests you know, I it was really, really obvious. Hmm. But I think overall, I think the way they, I think discuss matters in representing their strong views was still respectful.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you feel the structure of the AMWIC was set up in such a way that even though there were some caucuses and there were some inequities in power dynamics, that it was still a structured process that was fair and everybody got a chance to speak and everybody listened, you know,
I think,
respectfully to each other.
Gosh, I forgot her name, but they hired
Mary Orton,
mm-hmm. and she was good. I tell you, I have the highest respect for her. And when they somehow didn't renew her contract, I was the only one that objected to it, and they now got her back.
But yeah, we interviewed her. She had a
Yeah, I was the only one from the AMWIC that objected to her contract. But, you know, but she's back. But I think she was the one who kept AMWIC on an even keel.
Mm-hmm.
She was very, very highly proficient in her role in moderating the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And the technical help she has in terms of motions, and they would flash it on the screen, get it edited right there, and debate it. And wow, she had a big brain to remember all the discussions. Remember, you said this thing. This is that what you meant, you know? Yeah, Mary Orton was her name, and I went back and forth after she wasn't working anymore, and I told her I would try to get her back on, which we did.
She told us when we interviewed her, she told us about a very important river trip in which a key group of stakeholders went and kind of hammered out a new way of thinking about and working together. Were you on that river trip?
That's what I'm saying. Me and Kurt were on the river trip, I believe. But see that was right after the Record of Decisions, when the feds were now also getting these river trips together for the stakeholders, see. But early on, when we were writing our research proposal, the Hopi proposal was to have an integrated approach for the three sciences. And so we were talking with Dave Wagner about the future of the dam after the Record of Decision already. So between the three of us, we began to try to formulate how is this going to work, you know, because we were now realizing that there's an enormity of stakeholders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we would have now science to guide us, right? And science would still be ongoing. So the whole management had to adapt to those circumstances. Me, Kurt, and Dave Wagner were the ones that formulated that. And that's what we brought in to some of the first cooperating agency meetings, where that term and concept later became formal.
So that's again in the early 1990s.
Yeah,
right?
Well, we began to talk about that early on.
Mm-hmm.
And then now to implement it through AMWIC, to establish AMWIC, you know. Yeah, we talked about it a lot, and I think Dave also needs to be credited in giving us a sense of that concept, too.
Mm-hmm. So looking long-term at the program and your long decades of experience with it, do you think that it's been largely successful? And how so?
Well, I think with the level of effort we did, I think it's highly commendable. I think the support we have internally, the religious community coming in to give us that direction. And individuals within the Bureau of Reclamation that were very good people to work with, you know. And
do you remember any specific people in the Bureau of Reclamation that you felt were good to work with?
Let's see, some have gone already too back then, and then...
Do you remember Dave Garrett?
Dave Garrett was one of them too, yeah.
We interviewed him and he expressed a lot of support and concern for getting more robust tribal participation.
Yeah, he was one that supported us a lot, and we actually would invite him to our tribal caucuses too.
Oh.
And sometimes we would ask the secretary to come in too on our tribal caucuses.
Uh-huh.
So they would sit in, have lunch with us, and we would round table these things. So it's a matter of courtesy to them.
You mean the Secretary of the Interior's designee, Ann Castle?
Yeah, Ann Castle would sit in with us and have lunch with us.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I think they appreciated that, because there was now some discussions from the respective tribes that she would hear direct from one-to-one, too. And so then they would, after the caucuses, then on a very specific issue, then they would designate someone to articulate that during that discussion. That's how we worked.
The regular AMWIC meeting.
Yeah, our AMWIC meeting, like that. And they were privy to that. So Garrett was one of them. Yeah, so I think those kind of support, I think, helped a lot. I advocated for, particular for more money to get into the natural science component of it, but I wasn't successful in doing that. I wanted to get some of our younger people who were over at NEU in geology, for example, to actually come in and get funded or a program funded at NEU to support those students. But I never was able to find justification to do that. Mm-hmm. We have an MOU with NAU, the Hopi Cultural Preservation Office, and that's meant to facilitate that. Mm-hmm. But we just couldn't break loose the money.
Mm-hmm.
And we still have some students in there. I mean, it's still going on, and I wish we could get money to get a strong, you know, science, natural resource, natural science program over at NAU. And that would be one of my recommendations,
mm-hmm.
you know, is that the tribes need support there to offer scholarships and internships, you know, to continue to support them through their master's and even into their doctoral programs,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Other than some struggles with adequate funding to support, you know, research and participation, are there any other disappointments or what you consider to be limitations or flaws in the program as it's developed over time?
Well, it's adaptive management. So I suppose you're going to have changes throughout the implementation of the Record of Decision. And I think resources are always going to be a problem. I think the power interests are still going to present their views on everything. They're a major stakeholder. But I think the way it started, even from the cooperating agency standpoint, because a lot of us floated into the AMWIC, a lot of us did, was that at that level of cooperating agency, I think everything was formal but yet informal. All right. It was different types of meeting that we would engage in as cooperating agencies, because we were still heading towards the Record of Decision. But you already had your complement of people now coming forward to be part of the cooperating agents, agencies. So from that point on, I think that acquaintances that I had early on with some of those same individuals, even people from WAPA, we began to know each other. You know, every day, I mean, every meeting we would say, hey, so we call each other by our name, do high fives. And so I think that in itself was a key moderator in how AmWIC later shaped itself to continue to conduct business in that way. So I think that, I think, was a good transition. And some of us holdovers contributed to that, I think.
So it sounds like you think the program has substantial value and ought to be continued?
I think so. I think so. You know, with the experimental water releases, for example, they're intermittent, right? They're intermittent. The fact of the matter is that there's still no sediment going downstream. That's a reality. So the water releases are intermittent. That's meant to help, right?
These high flow releases.
High flow releases. Yeah. So that's going to be ongoing, and that was part of AmWIC's decision eventually to do those. See, so that's happening now. So I think over time it's going to take a long time before that whole ecosystem. At least has some evidence of recovery. It ain't gonna happen, but some over time, you know. And that has to be still part of Hopi's interest. So I think from our part, it has to continue. That monitoring has to continue. And whether WAPA likes it or not, I think that has to happen.
Yeah, the long-term perspective, you can't learn a lot if you're only looking at something for a few years or a decade. So that long-term perspective and that learning and relationship building, you're saying, is really valuable. And
I think so, and I've always tried to do that in my capacity as director. You know, rather than be an adversary, I encourage partnership. And that's been my philosophy as a Hopi person. And that's how I try to represent the office here.
You have kind of stepped down from the really central role that you played for so many decades, and others are stepping in. So that's my next question, is what advice do you have for people who will be coming onto the AmWIC in the coming years? What advice would you give them about how to approach the task, how to think about their role, how to prepare to be effective?
Well, I'm still actually a voting member of AmWIC.
Good.
Yeah, my term hasn't ended, and the chairman hasn't replaced me with anybody, so I'm technically still a member of AmWIC. And like I said, one of my staff is my successor, and I think he's academically founded.
Well trained.
He's got a master's in anthropology, and has worked for me for about 12 years as an anthropologist and as a researcher. So. He's been attended the last one over in Flagstaff with me, and so I said that this is what happens here. A bunch of boring stuff.
So you're mentoring him.
Yeah, so tell me. So this is what happens, and these are the issues. So make sure that you, when you get the packet, make sure you take a look at it and see what is relevant to either Hopi or tribes, and continue to communicate with Mike Yates, who, by the way, is also retiring. Yeah, end of this year too. So he's been with me. He's going on 30 years this year too.
Wow.
Yeah. Kurt worked for me for about a dozen or maybe 15 years. Yeah.
And now he's working for the Zuni, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we interviewed him about a month ago.
Yeah. Yeah, he helped me get our archaeology program off the ground.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so we now have our full staff of archaeologists and everything. Yeah, so I think over time, I hope the Hopi tribe's participation doesn't wane, but continues to be as strong as it has been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Stewart will, again, like he's doing, he's learning the ropes, will learn the ropes on this whole program called AMWIC.
What are your hopes for the future? I mean, we've had almost 30 years of history with this program, and things related to water flows and fisheries and cultural resources have been addressed. What issues aren't being addressed, or what new issues do you think are going to come up that the AMWIC will have to face in the future?
Let me see. So, so I think some of the new changing facing AMWIC is something that I was curious about in terms of you know, the range of releases.
Mm-hmm.
That's dictated by the Record of Decision, because the Lake Powell is at 60% capacity right now.
Yes, yeah,
you know,
low.
And you see it physically. You see it, right? The white lines. It's
34
feet.
Right?
You know.
Yeah.
It's a lot of water. So I think that needs to be taken note of. How does that affect WAPA's water releases?
Yeah.
You know, and would that require a supplemental EIS at some point if it continues to go down, right?
Mm-hmm.
See? And I was looking at the data, and we're technically at a 20-year drought.
Mm-hmm.
And this is huge, and I know as a Hopi farmer, I know it, you know, and so I think that's a new issue that I think hopefully can be addressed at some point too, or prepared for. I think the control of trout is going to still be a population, still going to be a problem. I don't know how we address it, because there's just so many of them in there, from Lee's Ferry on all the way down to the confluence, you know.
Because of the colder, clearer water, it's good habitat for them.
Yeah, and that's been a big, big change for them, you know. And so that was one thing I was thinking about, the Lake Powell.
Yeah, that's what I had in mind. I mean, we're looking at a situation where it's possible that lake could continue to fall. It's, you know, it was when you started this program in the 1990s, that was only about 10 years after that huge flood of 1983.
Yeah.
The reservoir was still full as of about the year 2000.
Mm.
But now, you know, Lake Mead is a third full, and Lake Powell's half full, and there's no guarantee that the new climate regime isn't, you know, going to change and go back to what it was before. There's a chance
that
everything's going to be different, and this is an adaptive management program. Do you think about what kinds of adaptations might be facing us in the next 10 or 20 years if this is the new normal, this climate regime that we have now?
Yeah, well, I think... as a non-scientist, of course, you know, I see the low levels of Lake Powell, and look at the dam in itself, the height it is, and where the generators are located, you know. Because over time, I don't know what the projections was, but eventually it will fill up with sediment anyway, you know. But I'm just worried as the water goes down, what are the power engines, how are the power engines going to deal with that
right.
in terms of the fluctuations? Because they're currently allowed a certain range. And they'll probably put a big fight if we going to do it.
Reduce the range even more.
Because of the low levels of Lake Powell. I think that's the circumstances, again, that I'm speaking to right now. That's because we had a meeting up at Page the other day, and I went through it again, Lake Powell, the bridge, and over, and God, you know, the ramps are getting longer and longer, the boat ramps, you know, like that, and it's sad, you know. Maybe if it goes low, we'll see our archaeological sites again. 2,000 plus that were inundated.
Yeah.
We occasionally have to react to a remain that's eroded from somewhere and is found on the beach somewhere, a bone that turned to be prehistoric, whatever, then we do reburials on that. But and then... I think because of water shortage, I think there's going to be more impact, like with CAP, by CAP, Central Arizona Project, because of the water shortage. Because that's what they're drawing on to feed water into Phoenix and other areas. I think they're going to probably want to up that. You know, and the tribes adjacent them gonna wanna demand their share. So I think that's a long term effect of the ecosystem down there, where more water will have to be drawn out to address the drought right now. I think that's one thing that I've been thinking about too.
Well, last question: is there anybody else that you think we should be sure to interview? You've already mentioned a good number of people like Charlie Bullets and Tim Begay and Octavius
Sotewa,
Loretta Jackson, L.M. Downer.
Yeah, Ellen Downer's over in Hawaii sipping margarita on the beach.
Maybe we can go join him and interview him there. anybody else that you thought played an important role or would have an unusual perspective?
Well, you interviewed Jan, for example, but...
And we interviewed Dave Wagner.
Let me see. The other two, if you're able to reach them, because they were instrumental in Amwick recently, are the former Park Service Superintendent.
Steve Martin? Or somebody before him? Or after him?
After him. Well, Steve Martin was involved, too.
Yeah, I think he's might be back in the Flagstaff area. I'm thinking about
Steve.
Maybe.
Steve?
Yes.
Yeah, they have a home there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it was the person who came after Steve Martin? I forgot his name too.
Yeah,
sorry.
Dave... dang, what was his last name? He had a kind of funny last name.
I thought Steve Martin was a funny name, too.
I thought he was a comedian.
Exactly. Yeah, I can look it up.
And then, after Steve was another superintendent. What was his name? Unger?
Dave Unger?
Dave Unger. Or Dave, yeah, Unger, I think.
All right. I'll look it up. And you remember him as important because...
Well, they were instrumental when Steve was there during the the initial phases where we were in the 90s up, and then he left. Mm-hmm. And then another superintendent took over, and he was there for a long time. Arnsberger.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, Dave.
Arnsberger. And so he was there for quite a while, and yeah, he'd be a good person to talk to.
Yeah, they were on our tribal caucus when it came to votes.
You had a lot of support from the Department of Interior agencies, it sounds like.
Yeah,
other than
did.
Maybe Bureau of Reclamation. Did they attend your caucuses, BOR?
No, we never invited them.
All right. Well, I think we've covered everything. Is there any last comments you'd like to make before we shut off the tape recorder?
Well, let me see. Since you have our report, the one that we did, I took a look at it. That,
yes,
of course, lays out really the cultural values of the Grand Canyon.
Right.
So feel free to draw on that.
Thank you. Any other documents that you can think of?
Yeah,
that
right.
Are important.
Well, on the record of decision, there's appendices of all the tribal chapters. There's a Hopi chapter, Paiute chapter, Navajo chapter, Zuni chapter. They're all in there as part of the EI record of decision. So I think that would be a good source for you to mm-hmm. do. It pretty much synthesizes what is in our big report.
Okay.
But it has all of our initial recommendations.
All right.
So that comes to my mind. Just tell Bureau of Reclamation I want more money.
Yes, you're probably aware of this. Just in the last couple of months, the Trump administration has announced that they're sweeping all the funds, that all the hydropower revenue that had been funding this program is going to Treasury.
Yeah.
And there's a chance that the program may no longer exist by
right.
2019.
Yeah.
That would be a shame.
Yeah, that was an alert last fall already on that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to be too bad if it does, because there's so much energy, put into this effort here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in my opinion, it's an effort worthwhile. And I think with what's at stake in terms of the canyon being a very special place for us, all of America, I think a sense of monitoring and caretaking and good management is really needed into the future. That's what I think.
I think that's a great place to stop.
Yeah.
Wonderful.